Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So good evening and welcome. For those who don't know me, my name is Larry Kramer, and I'm the President and Vice Chancellor here at LSE. And it's my pleasure and honor to welcome you to this very special event. Co-hosted by the Grantham Institute, the Global School of Sustainability, and the Suntory and Toyota International Centers for Economic and Related Disciplines, which around here is known as STICRD. Now, I'm going to say I'm a materialist, which used to drive my wife crazy. She was very spiritual by nature, so I don't usually believe in things like fate. But then sometimes you do just have to wonder. Today, April 22nd, is Earth Day. And by coincidence, it is also Professor Lord Nicholas Stern's birthday. It is, in fact, his 80th birthday, which seems impossible and has me wondering whether Nick is, in fact, one of those immortal warriors competing for the prize in Highlander. Okay. Ooh, that may be too obscure a reference for those who don't indulge in cheesy sci-fi as I do. In any event, given his life's work, one could hardly think of a better day to celebrate Nick than Earth Day, nor a better day to celebrate the Earth than Nick's birthday. Now, I realize many of you here are Nick's friends and students and so familiar with his biography. That may be actually most of you. Nick is one of those people about whom you can say you're one of his 10,000 best friends. The difference being that, from what I can tell, Nick really is genuinely friends with 10,000 people. On top of that, the panel, as you see, it's about as star-studded a panel as one can create, which means, quite reasonably, so I'm not at all insulted that none of you is here to listen to me. On top of which, I should say, one of Nick's birthday wishes was that we not make this whole event about him. And so despite all of that, I'm going to beg your indulgence to bear with me for a few minutes because I can't just say nothing. Nick is, on any view and by any measure, one of the very best and most important social scientists of his or any generation. He is, of course, among the world's preeminent environmental economists, but that doesn't even approach the sum of his contributions to society or to his discipline. He is also literally, and in the best sense of the word, the Platonic ideal of a public intellectual who, over the course of his long and exceptional career, has been totally dedicated to putting great ideas into practice for the world's benefit. Nick's body of work is not confined to the pages of scholarly journals to be read only by a small slice of his fellow academics. It is, in fact, the definitive examination of the economic consequences, including opportunities, resulting from climate change in a way that has been essential reading required of world leaders, ministers, and pretty much everyone else who wants to play a role in dealing with the climate catastrophe. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that no thinker on Earth has been more influential on the public policy response to climate change and the need for a transition to a sustainable, inclusive, and resilient global economy. And while Nick's role on the world stage is what most people would probably want to emphasize in talking about him, for us at LSE, Nick's role on campus has mattered just as much. Nick is rightly beloved by generations of students for a lifetime of teaching. He's also an incredibly generous and hardworking colleague who elevates our research output and public engagement, as well as an inspirational leader who has brought to LSE institutions like the Grantham Research Institute and our new Global School of Sustainability. He has, moreover, been a trusted advisor and helper to every director or president of LSE for decades, including this one, as well as an extraordinary friend. LSE is a special institution with a really special history. But what makes it special, what makes any institution special, is the people. And at the end of the day, that's what we're all about. And there are very few people in the extraordinary 130-year history of this extraordinary institution who've been more important or more special in making it what it is. Nick Stern is a scholar, a teacher, a citizen of the school, and a friend and a colleague to all of us. Now, celebrating this milestone birthday, and celebrating it this way with a panel, I should say, and focusing on some of the issues that have defined Nick's life and legacy seems to me exactly and perfectly the right thing to do. And we have not just any panel. Panel that's honestly so ridiculously impressive that introductions can and will be kept short. And this, too, I should say, is a testament to Nick, because who else could have attracted these people? Yep. We are, in any event, unbelievably fortunate to have these three guests with us this evening to discuss big ideas in the service of public policy. Kristalina Georgieva has been managing director of the International Monetary Fund since October 2019, before joining the IMF. You know, I was looking down, I thought that was for me. Before joining the IMF, she served as CEO of the World Bank, where she held the role of interim president. Previously, she helped shape the agenda of the European Union, first as Commissioner for International Cooperation, Humanitarian Aid, and Crisis Response, and later as Vice President for Budget and Human Resources. During her academic career, she was a visiting fellow at LSE, which is close enough to make her an alum in my book. Christine Lagarde has been President of the European Central Bank since 2019. I'm going to feel really bad if you do nothing for me. Between 2011 and 2019, she served as Kristalina's predecessor as managing director of the IMF. Prior to that, she served as France's Minister of Economic Affairs, Finance, and Employment, as well as in various other ministerial roles. A lawyer by background, her career began there, and when she left legal practice to enter public service, she was chairman of the global firm Baker & McKenzie, which, for those who are in the know on law, was the world's first great global law firm. She also has an honorary doctorate from LSE, again, good enough to make her an alum. Good enough to make her an alum in my book, and of course, her greatest accolade. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala has been Director General of the World Trade Organization since 2021. She was the first woman and first African to hold that position. Alongside a distinguished career at the World Bank, where she rose to be Managing Director of Operations, she twice served as Nigeria's Finance Minister and was also Foreign Minister, the first woman in both those roles. She, too, holds an honorary doctorate from LSE. We do try to get all the best people. So our program for the evening is pretty straightforward. We're going to begin with a conversation between me and the panelists, which is really me just asking them questions to get them to open up some of the issues. For further discussion, we'll do that for maybe 40 minutes or so, maybe a little longer, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience, both here and online. And where is my online person? There you are. Okay. A note for social media users following the conversation, the hashtag for today's event is @LSEEvents. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And I can't wait for the day when I don't have to add that clause, because we know there will be no technical difficulties. Okay, so let's open it up with a kind of broad question for each of you. In your experience or in your domain, what ideas do you feel have made the greatest difference to meeting global challenges? And do you both want to start?
Yeah. Yes, I will. Nick gave us marching orders that this should be a light event. And I will start with a story. God calls Moses and says, "Moses, my son, I have two pieces of news for you. One is good, the other one is bad. Which one do you want first?" Moses says, "Well, give me the good news first." God says, "You will raise your hand, split the sea, take your people to safety." Moses says, "God, there cannot be bad news after this." God says, "Not so fast. You will have to prepare an environmental impact assessment first." And why am I starting with this story? Because one of the most significant developments, and Nick was the one to drive it, was when we finally realized that care for the environment, care for our climate, is good for the economy. once we move the conversation from being, if you care for the environment, that's bad news economically, to if you care for the environment, if you fight climate change, this is a new economic model. He turned the view on its head. And I cannot tell you how important it has been to bring this conversation from the environmental ministers to the finance ministers and to make it about the prospects for economies, businesses, and people to grow. I think this idea is to be advanced further, Nick, but I wanted to start by recognizing this has been tremendously important. How many agree with that? How many of you agree with that? Hey, I also owe you, we were instructed to talk about ideas from our field of responsibility. At the IMF, what we do is to help countries and the world economy to do better. And what we have discovered over many decades is that to do better, they need to have strong fundamentals. They need strong and independent institutions like independent central banks, fiscal councils. They have to have clarity of what their strategy is and then pursue it. And the idea I want to bring to your attention is that we are now in a world that has changed dramatically in one aspect. We now have more frequent and severe shocks that most of the time are exogenous because of, well, we lived through the pandemic, because of health crisis, global, because of geopolitics, because of climate, sometimes because of demography. So these frequent shocks put a very big burden on many countries, especially poor countries, and they pose a question: how do we? What should we do? And the answer we are offering from the fund is to say, look, you can't really influence the exogenous shocks yourself, but you have agency over your own policies, over your own institutions. And if in the past we thought about these fundamentals as necessary for growth and prosperity, now we have to think about them also because they are a source of resilience. They protect people, communities, and businesses. So we want to think about that, this notion of resilience, and how what we do at the fund to help countries build these strong fundamentals can be further deepened. And of course, we count on good research. What are the interlinkages? How we bring public support? One of the problems we know is there is Jean-Claude Juncker formulated it. We all know what we need to do. We don't know how to get reelected when we do it. How can we build that public support? What are the keys to unlock this puzzle? So I would. It is something that kind of sounds like, well, fundamentals. What's new about them? I think what is new is that we are in a different place in terms of the risks that are presented to economies. They come, just think about Mythos and the risk to financial stability. It requires from us interdisciplinary approach, and it requires understanding how societies work, what can bring support for action. And LSE is fantastic in doing exactly this type of research. Thank you.
We should hope we'll never get through if you guys applaud after every answer. So we'll save that for the end.
Well, thank you. I think I'll reverse what Kristalina did and start with my idea and end up with Nick somehow. We'll see how it works. But, I mean, this question of a big idea that has made helped us manage global challenges is really very important to think through. And if you ask me in the area, which is the area of global trade, the multilateral trading system, what is the idea that has really made a big difference, and I think makes a difference today and in the future? It's the idea of interdependence. Mm-hmm. Just think about it. You know, we normally, human beings are interdependent. We know that we have to rely on systems and on each other to survive. But in 1795, Immanuel Kant wrote an essay on this issue of interdependence, and that's where it all started. The idea that if countries, societies can work together, their economies can interact, and you have some kind of international law that helps it, mold that and support it, that they'll be less prone to conflict, that notion. And I think in the 19th and 20th century, this idea was picked up by many other scholars and intellectuals. And I think crystallized in Joseph Nye's complex interdependence concept, where he spelled it out a bit more, that when society, economies are interdependent and work with each other, when you have global institutions and law supporting all of this, you really have societies that are less prone to conflict. Mm-hmm. So this is a concept that I think underlies what we see has happened in the multilateral trading system and in global trade. It gave the foundation for really building up post-World War II in 1947, what became the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. This idea that if you can get countries trading with each other, they'll be less prone to thinking about war. And this led over 40 years to 8 rounds of negotiations that culminated in the Uruguay round and created the World Trade Organization in 1994-95. So interdependence. And why am I so enamored of it? Because I think it worked. It delivered. It delivered 80 years of peace. I want people not to forget about that. You know, yes, we had conflicts here and there, but we didn't have the kind of really major global war that we see today. It lifted 1.5 billion people out of poverty. It made the developed countries more developed and richer. Their consumers benefited from global supply chains that made consumer goods cheaper. And in developing countries, as I said, 1.5 billion were lifted out of poverty. Yes, not every part of the world benefited. You know, Africa didn't benefit as much as it should. Mm-hmm. Still 3% share of global trade. Even within rich countries, there were poor regions that didn't benefit as much. So I don't want to exaggerate, but this very notion of interdependence helping us to manage economics, conflict, security, in so many ways, is something that I think is so essential. It works today. I think it will work in the future, maybe slightly differently. Mm-hmm. But it is a really big idea to me that I think we need to husband and think carefully about before we allow it to fly away from us. So that's that. Now, thinking about this interdependence and what it means for global trade and global economic interaction leads me to, you know, Nick's ideas. And, you know, Nick and I first, you know, you came to Nigeria when I was Minister of Finance, and you helped me to talk to Cabinet about the need to do reforms. We had to do fundamental reforms. We were co-chairing the Global Commission on Economy and Climate for a number of years. But I think Nick's magic for me was liberating my mind from the thought that, you know, the climate, that there are these fundamental trade-offs between climate action and growth. The idea that you don't need to think about it in that way, and that you can have a new climate economy that really needs to a different kind of growth that generates millions and millions of jobs, and they are not in conflict, is very liberating, because it allows you to think of all areas of the economy and how they can work to contribute to growth whilst at the same time fighting climate. And when I came, everybody was about trade is negative for climate change. But with this open mind, we could really think at the WTO of so many numerous ways in which trade can, does, and should be used to fight climate. Mm-hmm. Yes. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Well done. You're doing it. No, every answer will deserve applause, so.
You have limited authority, eventually.
I know, well, you get used to that.
You don't want them to cheer us on?
No, that's fine. That's what he said.
I want to save it all for a huge, tumultuous ending.
Right. Okay. So, Ngozi, thank you, because you're giving me a chance to arbitrate between the trade-off that I couldn't actually arbitrate with. And you helped me bridge interdependence and independence. So, interdependence. If I look at the question that you had very nicely sent, the answer for me is obviously Europe. And when I look... think about it. I look at someone who is 80 years of age, who's been a luminary and who's been Magic Nick, as Ngozi rightly said. Europe has been an amazing catalyst for peace. Mm-hmm. If you look at the challenges... if you look at the conflicts and the global issues that we had to deal before that, it revolved massively around economic crisis, world wars, one, then two, then more economic crisis. And what actually helped change that in a continent that had been at each other's throat for centuries was actually Europe, which decided to put 11, then 15, then eventually 27 countries in interdependency. It might be laborious, might be difficult, it might be criticized, and my gosh, we've seen so much Europe bashing in the last few weeks. But it is just a magnificent construction to address the global challenges. So that was my gut feeling instinct, and my team said, no, the end of the question says that it's a new current field. So I come to independence. And clearly what has made central bankers' life much easier and their ability to deliver on their mission actually real has been independence. Because if I look back over the last 60, 70, 80 years since Nick was born, in the 80s and 90s, that's when the concept of central bank independence came about after decades of very high inflation, when it was just assumed that fiscal and monetary could just come along and that the trade-off would always work out. Well, unfortunately, it was a mistake. It didn't work out. And it's only because central bank became independent, either by treaty, as is the case in the European Union, in the euro area, or otherwise by law in some corners of the world. But it is that independence that actually gave credibility, gave the responsibility of the central bank to actually ensure the stability of price without which investment, employment, decision-making by households and corporates cannot happen in a proper environment. So it's much more pedestrian, it's much more sort of local to central banks, mm-hmm. my concept yep. of independence, but I think the two operate interdependence to address the major challenges, because there is no worse challenge, with all due respect to what you have said, and rightly so, on the protection of Mother Earth and the risk that climate change bring about. But the worst that can happen anywhere in the world is war. Mm-hmm. You can do anything you want, but it destroys more than anything else. And to address that issue, interdependence and the acknowledgement that Immanuel Kant was rightly pointing out is exactly that. And the response to it in terms of policy and structure is, for example, Europe. Mm-hmm. You don't applaud. That's okay.
So those answers actually, I think, lead nicely into a different question, which is, obviously the world has never been a completely passive, settled, everybody getting along perfectly way. Mm-hmm. But the balance between interdependence and independence in terms of sovereignty has varied over time. Most of us grew up in a world you would have said was bipolar, mm-hmm. although it doesn't quite work in this context. and then for a period of time, unipolar. And we're now looking at a world world that at best is multipolar and seems to be much more fractious than anything we've seen since the pre-World War II era. So in the world that's emerging, what do you think is possible for the kinds of work that your institutions have been after for all this time?
Well, the very first thing we need to do is to recognize what the world is and where it is headed. The worst thing we can do is to fall in a place of nostalgia for the unipolar world. I grew up on the other side of the Iron Curtain in Bulgaria, and during the Cold War, I can vouch it was really cold over there. And that came to an end, and there was a transformation, very positive, because that was the time when the term peace dividend became very prominent. We saw money going into education, healthcare, infrastructure, climate action because of the peace dividend. But then we moved into a place where we are today. Clearly, for many countries, the issue of national security has taken an upper hand, and everywhere I go, I listen to discussions around how can we lift up defense budgets. In parentheses, at the fund, we did a piece of very interesting research on what happens when countries have a defense boost. In about 3 years' time, what they would see is their budget deficit would go up by around 2%+, and their debt would go up by around 7%. So unless there is thinking in advance how to prevent these investments that, yes, they can have an effect on the economy. By the way, they are investments with much higher multiplier than investments in defense. But in this case, countries are doing it because of genuine worry about the safety of their citizens. So what is so important to recognize that we have moved in a space of multiple centers of gravity, and we need to recognize that the best we can do is to support countries that have economic and other interests to work together. At the fund, we are supporting ASEAN, we are supporting the Gulf Cooperation Council, we are supporting countries in Africa to identify how they can compensate for the decline overall in global cooperation by building these linkages still within the framework of multilateralism. I want to tell you something that so much impressed me last week, boosted my optimism for the future of the world. We had our spring meetings. Spring meetings and annual meetings is when our members come together. At this time, we had a record attendance. So last time when we had spring meetings happened to be when trade tensions picked up. What was the impact? We had at that time record attendance vis-a-vis the past. This time we beat this record not by a percentage or two, by 13% in terms of delegates coming. And the record of meetings that take place, bilateral, multilateral, plurilateral meetings, went up by 22%. What this tells me is that at the time of uncertainty, countries actually seek cooperation, and it is our duty, Ngozi's duty, my duty, to provide space when they would feel they can trust this space, that they would be fairly treated, where the engagement is going to be for their benefit. What is our duty? To give a sense as to, in this fog of uncertainty, where the world economy is going, and then help countries find a path that would be successful for them. So my answer to your question is that when we are able to answer this, to when we are able to reflect on this for each and every one of our members, we have 191 countries. What is in for me? When I cooperate with others, how is this making lives of people in my country better? And the more we lean forward with answers to these questions, the more we create an environment, an inclusive, respectful environment, the better chance we have for interdependence to bring positive results. And let me tell you, since I have lived through the collapse of the other system, change is unstoppable for good and for bad. So it is our job to minimize the costs on people and to maximize the benefits. Change makes impossible things possible. I graduated from Karl Marx University of the Economy, and today I run the IMF. I rest my case.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say, Kristalina, that when we all come for the spring meetings and the annual meetings, I was saying at the IMFC, at the International Monetary and Finance Committee, finance ministers get together. It's all very nice and civilized. It's a good conversation. We exchange ideas and we have all these beautiful things. That's not what happens with trade ministers. Trade ministers meet every 2 years in a very compressed time frame of 4 or 5 days, all of them. And what do they come to do? I made the mistake of saying at the development committee that they come to work, implying our colleagues, finance ministers, are not working. That's not what I'm saying. But trade ministers come to negotiate deals and agreements and multilateral agreements. And each one is coming with their own domestic agenda. It makes for an atmosphere that is stressed and that is highly, sometimes toxic, as each person tries to put their own agenda forward. So I said to Development Committee and IFC members, it's no fun. And sometimes at the end of the 4 or 5 days, you get a, think you've got a bundle of deals, and some member comes and says, I won't join the consensus. Because at the WTO, consensus means unanimity. Everybody must agree. So if one person wakes up and all your nice negotiations, one member says no, then you spend 4 days, 5 days in a pressured environment, and then at the end you can't deliver. So it's not the fun. It's not. We go there every 2 years with dread about what's going to happen. So just to correct, to give you the right impression, nevertheless, I cannot complain of boredom in my job, because I never know what's going to happen from 1 minute to the next. But coming, I wanted to say, Larry, that the multipolar world that we have now, I think is leading to a lot of stress and tensions. I think it's that multipolarity that is causing a lot of the tensions and conflict. You know, I mean, now countries of the so-called global south contribute more than 56% of global GDP.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Today, in 1995, south-south trade was 10% of global trade. Today it's 25%, and it's growing. So all these, I'm speaking from the trade perspective, I think some of these things happening are leading to the types of tensions we see as the unipolar or bipolar world has to contend with what multipolarity means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's leading to tensions. If you couple that with the kind of changes we're seeing with technology and AI, we live in a world that is really, in a way, on the one hand, you could say it's exciting, but on the other hand, it's troubling and worrying and stressful. So when you put all that together, you have to ask whether our institutions are fit for purpose to handle such a world. And I'll just speak for mine. And I said it, I think, here when we had the session with Nick and Amartya Sen. I think the WTO is one of the most interesting institutions in the world, because of what it's doing that no one knows about. I'll come back to that. But it's also, it needs to be made fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. I believe it really needs to change that. Look, you can say multilateralism. Don't be defensive. I don't feel defensive about being criticized. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should be defensive when multilateralism is criticized, because we are not going to get away from needing it. What we should do is say, look, what's good about multilateralism that we need to preserve, and what do we need to change? And that's the way we approach at the WTO. What is it that needs to be preserved? Because there's a lot that is good that people don't know about. And I'll repeat my joke. The WTO and its rules are like the plumbing in your house. You don't notice or know what they're about until the pipe breaks and your precious Persian rugs are ruined. That's when you wake up and say, my plumbing really matters. The WTO holds the rules that your business is straight with every day without even your noticing. When you walk into a store and what you want is on the shelf, you don't think about it. How did it get here? How was it made? Why is it costing this much? How come the standard of the product is good, and I can have some trust that when I consume it or wear it, I'll be okay? All those are rules held at the WTO that no one knows about. Okay, so it is so good that we have to preserve it. The WTO holds rules on intellectual property that generate more than $500 billion, $500 billion every year in payments for patents and so on, $144 billion of which goes to the US, a quarter to the EU, so the developed countries get most of it. But does anyone know this is even happening? No. So we have to preserve what's good, but recognize that the way we make decisions, we have to look at it. When consensus becomes unanimity, what happens? You can get paralyzed. You can have a good agreement and one member says, no, I don't agree with that.
India.
You said India. I didn't say that. I'll be drawn and quartered. That's Christine Lagarde. Not Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. Otherwise, when I get back to Geneva tomorrow morning, I'll have certain ambassadors at my door and ministers calling. But anyway, yes, one member comes, you know, and we had an agreement and that we were negotiating. Two members say we don't join the consensus. That cannot be the way to make decisions in a fast-moving AI world.
Yeah.
That has to change. Plurilaterals, coalitions of the willing that come together to look at what is needed in this new environment. And within the WTO, and it's allowed, we're allowed to have plurilaterals. That's the way to go. Just to give you one example, I could go on and on because I find it really, really interesting. But let me end this segment by saying one of the reasons that I really am passionate about the organization is because of its purpose, which nobody ever talks about. Its purpose, as written in its founding document, is to enhance living standards, to help create employment, and to support sustainable development.
Yes.
That was 1995. What could be better than that? Yeah. It's all about people.
Marrakesh.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. Yes.
So I want you to know that these two ladies are telling the truth. Because I was finance minister and I was trade minister. And everything that they described is right. And the only reason I said India is because I have been there, I've seen it, and I know who is always objecting at the last hour.
Actually, India was pretty good at MC14 at our ministerial. Miraculously.
Okay, what I would like to say is we are living in times when long-standing institutions, such as the Bretton Woods Institution, such as the successor of the GATT, the WTO, and a few other ones, are challenged. And where the membership of those institutions is questioning the purpose that they serve and is challenging the efficiency of the institutions. And I believe that we live in times where we all need courage, and the courage to stand for the principles that we hold high. We need communities of those who believe in the same purpose, and you've identified the mission of the WTO. It's clearly one that is in very high regard. And in those communities, we need leaders. And I would like to acknowledge you, Nick, as a leader in that community of those who, in their respective field, and it has been my case when I was at the IMF, it is my case at the ECB, who have recognized that climate change and nature protection are both critically important, both macro, from a macro-critical point of view, macroeconomic point of view. But you, as a person, are a community leader. And it's with a lot of concern and a lot of affection that many of us are here with you. Because in times when those issues and those principles are undermined, challenged, and when the institutions that normally serve those purposes are shaken, it's really tremendously important that you continue to lead and to serve that community with the courage and the force that you've always demonstrated. And I say that with great affection and great respect and gratitude for what you have done and continue to do. So courage, community. The third C that I would mention is creativity, because the institutions that are represented here and others are reservoir of knowledge, of goodwill, of a sense of mission that should not be left to drift. I heard the word rupture. We heard the word we're moving into a new paradigm. But this is all well and good for a speech, and I tend to agree with that, although when I hear the word rupture as a woman, I think of birth. And maybe that's what we should be doing, helping with the birth of these institutions, except rejuvenated, with different voting system, with different principles, with better quotas, better aligned with what the world has become, far more representation of emerging market economies. This needs to be done, and it will only be done with the creativity of those like you, the students, have in mind the future and improving the way we work together and the world where we operate. But this is going to be badly needed, and I see a mission for the academic institutions to help those who work within these institutions and in a way are prisoners of the paradigm in which we have evolved. We need you. Courage, creativity, community. Thank you.
Yep. Yes.
So, Christine, let me stay with you for a moment and maybe push on that a little more. So, you know, what, in a sense, the last answers are all about, we have these challenges to advance growth, to advance development, to deal with climate change. So across a whole lot of different dimensions, what can universities offer?
They can offer bridges. They can offer open door. They can offer open knowledge. And I think that at times when we talk about building walls, separating, protecting, preserving, being so risk averse that we don't want to let others look at what we are doing and over our shoulders, I'm always reminded of two particular areas where having open knowledge and being prepared to share was actually a fantastic service to humanity. If you think, I'll go back to exactly his title, because he was Norman Borlaug. Norman Borlaug. Yeah. His name rings a bell for some of you. Yeah. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1970 because what he did with what he called the Green Revolution is he prevented the famine and possibly the death of a billion people. Now, how did he do that? He wasn't actually trying to save a billion people. He was studying and had a PhD in plant pathology. That's what I didn't want to miss. Plant pathology. And he was studying at University of Minnesota. Wheat rust. But the work that he was doing, because it was open knowledge, because others could participate in and could help along, and because he pursued the adventure, that led him to figuring out how agriculture could be transformed in such a way that it would feed the billion people that were at risk of famine. That's one. The second one is a fascinating one. It started with Monod and his friend Jacob. They were two scientists, and they got the Nobel Prize as well. But they were the one who started the mRNA work. That was followed, because it was open science, because it was available, it was followed by further researchers that went a little bit further in the use of mRNA research to focus on how you can cure cancer. Now, many of you remember COVID. Many of you remember how long it took to produce a vaccine. In the past, minimum 4 years. COVID, 1 year. Why was that? Because the open work that had been produced by Jacob and Mono and then a team that was led by Catalina Carrico, that work that was open for all, helped those scientists from BioNTech and from Moderna, one in Germany, one in the United States, to actually produce the COVID-19 vaccine, which saved more than 1 million people. So what universities can do is continue to do research in sometimes unpredictable directions, in areas that you don't suspect will be transformational, but make it as open as possible and be as welcoming to new ideas as you can. I know that there are many talents and scientists and professors that are coming over to Europe at the moment. We should welcome them. We should not build bridges. We should not be restrictive. We should be open arms, and with the result of the research that we produce and that they produce, lead to the derivatives of that work. You know, if you ask CERN, for instance, which is a fantastic, not university, but a research institute, you know, some of the very obscure work that they did eventually produced the GPS. If you look at Minitel, fantastic French invention, but the French were so protective. France Telecom kept it to itself, built walls around it, and it never became the internet that it should have become. So that's what I hope universities can produce. The research in unpredictable areas that can turn into fantastic outcome for security and for development.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'll just say, from your mouth to the UK government's ears. Let me ask you guys a slightly different question. Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, from my viewpoint, for the trade area, I really think that it's important. The academic community needs to produce facts and transparency. In the trading community, there's a lot of lack of trust. And so if the facts do not support my own ideas and my domestic policies, then they are not facts. So having objectives, so I want my own facts, okay, to support my own ideas. And if you produce objective information, let's say that we do, it's not taken as seriously as we would like. But having universities do this work, you know, as independent, neutral parties, I think is very, very helpful in trying to bring transparency and independent, independent observations on what's happening in that area. So I just wanted to say that work and innovation in thinking. Can you think of the areas where reforms are needed and what ideas, how would you suggest to us we move in those directions? So I think those are some of the things. And then lastly, I'd like to see more academics, at least in our area, cycle between real life, meaning maybe spend some time in these institutions, and academia. Nick, this is one of the things he excelled at. Anyway, I'm going to vote for Nick for the Nobel Prize. If he doesn't, you know, I think he should get it. But here is someone who managed to put practice with theory and with new ideas. We need academics to come and spend some time because it's a shock. When you might be there writing all these very elegant articles, and I love to read them, about what is happening in trade or in macroeconomics or in the financial sector. But when you actually step into these institutions to work, it's a different ballgame. So cycling and getting a mix of that experience, real world, with your academic, will make your work richer and more useful for us.
So let me shift grounds a little bit and come back to one of the other points, because one of the areas in which we have had the, and still have really, I think, the greatest degree of cooperation internationally is around climate change and biodiversity loss. So are there ways in which we can leverage that into increase, and how would you do it, increasing cooperation and across in other areas? Or you know, what are we going to do there?
So the... What we see in the world, I'm going to start with the more difficult piece. What we see in the world is we collectively suffer from attention deficit disorder. It's very hard for us as a global community to focus on long-term issues, and they stay focused and work on them towards solutions methodically. We are like an 8-year-old playing football, or as they call it in the US, soccer. So the ball is in one place, we all run to the ball, we leave the rest of the terrain not covered. So that's a big problem that is on the way of these long-term issues like biodiversity protection, like climate change, to get for us to get the transformative force in place that would bring the results that are really about our survival as humanity. The better news is that what I have witnessed, I have been in multiple institutions, is that we are recognizing the IMF, we recognize the macroeconomic significance of climate shocks and the opportunities for growth, productivity, employment related to climate action. We have done some interesting work around biodiversity, like one of our very brainy economists calculated the value of a whale from the perspective of CO2 emission reduction. And all of our institutions have done that work. I think I want to recognize Christine. She was the one that put the issue of climate as a macro critical on the agenda of the IMF. I came after her, I embraced it fully because it is true. The mission of the IMF is macroeconomic and financial stability for growth and employment. What macroeconomic stability if a hurricane takes away 200% equivalent of your GDP? And I vividly remember Christine hosting a conference on that. So at the fund, we have done a huge amount of methodological work to identify what are the opportunities and risks associated with climate as a macro critical issue. It's straight in our alley. You wouldn't be surprised there are different views around how much we should do or not do. These are our members. We are a membership organization, so I'm saying that wholeheartedly. I'm very respectful of the views of all members, but ultimately our job is to make sure we support countries to have better opportunities for their people, and that means integrating climate into the work we do. It worries me tremendously that we have these cycles of engagement and then disengagement. I actually have a solution. You want to know my solution to that? Okay, so here is my solution. AI is going to tremendously improve our longevity. All of us can live longer. So, Nick, over the next 100 years, I expect from you to keep us on this ball.
Yeah. Okay. I want to do one straight up Nick question. So, since this is in his honor, in what ways has Nick's thinking or you're working with him influenced you directly? Not in the broad sense you guys talked about, but you know, just more directly in your own thinking or work.
Well, he's been incredibly influential for me in terms of, I think the key learning that I took away from some of his books, and I've read not all of them, but I've read some, is the issue about transition. And the one that I try to really communicate as much as I can to the skeptics, and I have to deal with some of them. And they look at money, and they want to measure the risks and the upside and the downsides and the benefits. And the way in which you've articulated the fact that transition is going to be a lot less costly if we deal with it and if we conduct it properly than the risk of not doing anything and letting the accident of climate change happen. I think that was number one. Number two, I think valuing carbon pricing. I think that's another area where Nick has been tremendously helpful, both at the IMF, at the ECB. I've invited you, Nick, on several occasions in both the institutions, and each and every time, decent people with not too much skepticism or a priori listen to Nick, they turned on, they understand, they get it, and it changes and moves the needle significantly. So that to me has been, I think the two British gentlemen who have been critically important for me in that respect are Nick and Sir David Attenborough. The two of them, I would put you up there on a pedestal.
Well, I'll build on what Christine said. I mean, the whole issue of the cost of inaction.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That Nick, the whole notion from the Stern Review that really made people think differently has spurred lots of other work following that also talk about the cost of inaction. In the Water Commission that I also co-chaired with Taman, we came from that basis of what is the cost of inaction. And it is far more costly, you know, it's far less costly to act now. So that whole thing, but that really, it's so elegant. Mm-hmm. It's so simple, so elegant and so powerful. I think that with the idea of not necessarily approaching, you know, everything in economics as a trade-off, one against the other, but the possibility that you could spur growth through climate action, and you could create all these jobs, as I said at the beginning, and you don't have to spend your time wasting thoughts about what is the trade-off, but really, how can this body of action on climate generate new growth and new jobs? I think that really opened my mind in a way that has enabled me to think more freely in so many other areas, including in trade, okay? And to think creatively. So if you want to ask me what Nick did, it is just those two interlinked concepts have been very powerful to me in my own thinking and my own work. So that's what I'd like to say. So thank you, Nick.
I totally agree. These are, you know, the looking at cost of action against cost of inaction, and then recognizing that, oops, cost of inaction is higher. But one thing I want to say is that Nick has this ability to make it ultimately about people. Because if it is some abstract concept about the economy and you don't take it down to what does it mean for the lives of people, then it's kind of harder to embrace it. For me personally, what was very helpful when in the beginning of you turning the equation, people were still quite skeptical, is to say, our World Bank former chief economist said that, which of course on the two sides of the 19th Street, World Bank, IMF, carried a lot of water. So thank you, Mr. former World Bank chief economist.
I'm sure Nick is terribly embarrassed by all this.
Look, when do we have the privilege to sit in front of him and kind of tell him?
And a handful of his close friends.
And everybody. So, do you have students in the audience?
Yes, yeah, of course. There are many.
You guys are so lucky.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Last question, and then we'll go to the audience, and I want to wrap it around what a lot of the comments have been. So historically, there is a world order no matter what. It can be chaotic, it can be nothing.
Yep.
In the 20th century, we built a set of institutions, in particular post-World War II, to manage the global order and relations among countries, which was necessary because we are so much more intertwined than we used to be. And arguably, they are coming apart, or at least losing their efficacy. This was the Mark Carney speech at Davos, the use of the word. It was a kind of emperor's new clothes moment, I think, that for a lot of people captured something that we realized. So my question for each of you, given particularly your roles currently and in the past in institutions, is what do we do? Are these institutions reparable to restore? If not, how do we need to change them? It's easy to say they need to be made fit for purpose, but how do we do that? Do we need new institutions? How would we do that? Just what are your reflections on really reconstructing a global order that will work in the world that we're heading into?
I mean, clearly, if you are in the world of multiple centers of relevance and influence, then what we currently have will change. It is already changing. We have seen the emergence of many regional institutions, and it is a reflection of that change in the world. And then the question is, the institutions we currently have, are they relevant? And how do we know whether they're relevant? So I speak about the fund. I measure relevance with numbers. Are we shrinking in numbers of members or growing? And we are still growing. When I started, we were 189. We are now 191. Second, can we see that countries, by and large, take on board what we recommend? The answer is, by and large, yes. Not easy. There is always a temptation to go populist everywhere. I mean, I'll tell you one example of right now. We have a negative supply shock. I'm assuming this is mostly audience of economists. When you have negative supply shock, the worst thing you can do is to balloon demand. And yet we see here in Europe, not in the United Kingdom, by the way, the UK is doing better than overall continental Europe. We see untargeted on this one. Sorry. On this one.
She's
on
European, this one. So it's okay.
On this one.
Clocks are right twice a day, too.
And I'm sure people are very unhappy that the UK is not going with untargeted subsidies. What we see is in Europe, the total amount of subsidies 2.6% of GDP. We calculated that if Europe was to target only the 40% more vulnerable people, it would have been 0.9% of GDP. So, but at least what I can say is that we talk with people, they listen to us, not always they act upon what they hear, but we have engagement, and this engagement is very meaningful. The third thing I look into, what is the fund? The fund is a very interesting medical service. We take the vital signs of all economies, so we check, health check, how is your employment, how is your inflation, how is your growth, and then we give prescriptions. But the fund is also an emergency service, so we have countries in difficulty, and then we go and we provide balance of payment support to get them out of this difficulty. What is the demand? Highest in our history. We have highest in our history demand. We have right now exposure to 86 countries. So when I look at it, I'm saying, yes, we need to continue to improve, reform, tighten, look at priorities objectively, not be afraid to speak truth to power. But overall, if there was no institution like this, it would have been a loss, because there is no place to aggregate what is happening in the world, what is the health of the world economy, where it is headed, and no one to rescue countries in trouble. And we, what we have done, and I'm very proud, it started with Christine again, and I'm very proud to have pushed it further. There was time when the fund completely ignored the developing world, low-income countries, therefore the World Bank. But the members, I want to show you a slide. I want to show you a slide that we showed to our membership during the spring meetings. And I was told if I say I want to show you a slide, a slide would appear. And it does. So these are all the countries in the world. We split them into energy exporters and energy importers. Yellow, energy exporters. The rest, energy importers. Now we move them around to see which have fiscal space and which do not. They, in yellow, these are sub-Saharan Africa. Now, what is the message? That the quadrant of vulnerability are mostly low-income countries, fragile states. To put this in front of the whole membership some years ago would have been unthinkable. We go talk about systemically significant economies and not about the poor world. But when you leave the poor world unattended, it is horrible for people who live there. It is also a source of instability because travels. So that has happened in the fund over not a very long period of time. And I want to say that what I would expect from you, from the young people in this room, please come up with your thoughts, write your papers. What should we be 5 years from now, 10 years from now? I'm in my heart of heart, not because I'm the head of the IMF, because I care about the world, and I care especially for vulnerable people in this world. I can tell you that if today we lose the IMF and it doesn't exist, it would be incredibly hard, if not impossible, to put in place the family doctor with an emergency room for the whole world. So I feel my duty is to build this institution for service. And you can help us to make that service meaningful, because if we lose it, we are going to do damage to our world. So please do that.
Okay. Larry, I wanted to question a little bit the premise of your comment. Which I'm not sure I completely agree with. The one that started by saying that I don't feel defensive at all about criticism of multilateral institutions, or my own in particular. But, you know, the idea that the institutions are broken and you need to create new ones or, you know, do something, I want to quarrel with that a little bit. I think, and I'll speak on the trade side, for trade, this is the worst disruption of the global trading system and its rules in 80 years. There's absolutely no doubt about that. So, but I think we need to say, in the midst of these disruptions, what has really happened? And if you read all the literature, and not forget about what WTO says, because people might say, oh, they're biased. Just read independent. The global trading system has been extremely resilient. Every challenge you've thrown, global supply chains have managed to find a way to reconfigure, okay, and to deliver. Even within this crisis of the Iran war, what we're seeing is the configuration of supply chains trying to find alternative routes and shipping to deliver. So I think we should be careful in not being led into the premise that everything is broken. The trading system is exhibiting resilience. As I say, I'll come back to that. Resilience is not robustness. But before I comment on that, I want to give you another statistic. In this disruption, WTO members, the large majority, have continued to trade with each other on yes. WTO rules.
Yeah.
The large majority. We have calculated it at the WTO because we have a methodology which we've been using. Mm. You know, and prior to the tariffs, the reciprocal tariff era, it was 80% of global trade on MFN and other WTO rules. Today, it's 72%. Just think about it. Most people get shocked and they think I'm lying. I've told them our methodology is in a paper. Read it. If you have a better one, I'm ready to adopt it. No one has come forward so far to challenge the methodology we use to calculate the MFN. So when you say it's broken, let's be careful. 72% of world's goods trade still goes on WTO terms. It went slightly up to 76% when AIPA mm-hmm. was, the AIPA ruling came. It's come back down again with the section. Sorry to be so jargony, but I think you know what I mean. The new section 301s and 122s. You know, so we're at a... I don't want to spend time explaining that, but we're at 72%. So that's why I'm challenging the premise to say, let's be careful. The system is disrupted, but is it broken? What we need to ask ourselves is, one, what led to the disruptions in the first place? In my case, in trade. The disruptions happened because certain members felt that the system was no longer working as well for them, the U.S., and they have a point. Mm. Some of their criticisms are valid. Developing countries feel the system isn't integrating them as much as they would wish, and they have a point. Mm-hmm. Some of the criticisms are valid. Emerging markets. So WTO members have been leveling criticisms, and then it came to a point when maybe one or two of them felt we no longer can go along with this, and the big disruption came. But still, the bulk of them have not gone for tit for tat like in the 1930s when we had the Smoot-Hawley Act. They've been trading with each other. So let's ask what core of the system works and preserve it. What doesn't work that needs to be reformed? And what is missing, given that we need new rules to deal with the exciting opportunities in trade? And I want to tell you there are exciting opportunities. Larry, another thing I want to point out. Services trade, growing at over 5%. Digitally delivered services trade, everything traded over the internet, growing at 6% per annum. Green trade, $2 trillion. They're exciting opportunities. Do we have the rules to govern those? That's what worries me, that we should be reforming the organization. And yes, that's what we need. Reforms to take advantage of new opportunities and to correct what doesn't work. But doing it, we must preserve what works. So that's the way forward. It will lead to new types of arrangements, more plurilateral arrangements, more coalitions of the willing. They will be formed around a core of the WTO. And we don't mind them because most of these new agreements you see in trade are built on a WTO platform based on our rules. So they are complementary. We welcome them. We want them because we need to be more nimble, faster. So to end, I see a new era of a core of rules of global trade around an institution that needs to be reformed. I see new formations of new kinds of agreements built on that platform that are complementary and not opposing. So this is where I think we are going, if we implement those reforms.
To quote Monty Python, I'm not dead yet.
Okay, so I agree with many of the things that you just said, Ngozi, in terms of what will happen next, but it's a fact, and I agree with Kristalina that the first thing we have to do is acknowledge what we have and not have the nostalgia of the past. I think that's a very good premise. But the world order is disorderly at the moment, let's face it. And as a result of that, because it was based on maybe it was false ideas, that's the point that Mark Carney made in his speech. We had the sign outside in the windows, and we knew it wasn't right, but we had it anyway, and he decided to take down the sign. What I think will happen is, as you said, there will be a need for new forum, because mm-hmm. it cannot be the case that certain topics are off the table because they should not be discussed in the presence of some of the membership. So there will be new forum. There will be coalition of the willings. Mm-hmm. There will be discussions that will be had amongst those who want to pursue those topics. You know, the United States, for the second time, has left the Paris Agreement. We need to face the reality and be prepared to talk about those issues in different forum if necessary, and when the time comes, to reassemble, mm-hmm. and maybe that will be based on the common principles that you were referring to. Point number one. Point number two, I think that the current situation has led to an acceleration of history. If I look at, you know, Europe, and I would include for that purpose the UK, and I know that it's not part of the European community, but it's Europe as well. We have accelerated the signature, the negotiations of so many agreements. I mean, Mercosur, which is going mm-hmm. to enter into effect mm-hmm. on May the 1st, mm-hmm. the agreement that had been under negotiations with our good friends, India, is now completed. Mm-hmm. Yep. Europe, India is a fact. Australia, Indonesia. Yep. This yes. would not have happened yep. had we not had yes. the current situation. So it has been an accelerator of
yep.
multiple trade relationships. Are we at risk of having a big fat spaghetti bowl? Maybe.
Yeah.
But we can make sense of that cuisine quite well mm-hmm. at some stage.
With Nigerian sauce.
And I have one more point that I would like to make. I think that if policymakers, if governments do not move in that direction, the corporate sector will. Mm-hmm. You talked about True. Artificial intelligence, Kristalina, yep. and you True. Are right. But it requires mm-hmm. massive investment. The capex in AI are just beyond limits, mm-hmm. number one. The use of energy is currently beyond limits. Yeah. And until we have fusion and quantum, it's going to be massive. But that can only be justified if they can rely on data from all around the world, number one, because that is what feeds mm-hmm. their computing capacity at accelerated pace. So if we start having compartmentalized data, segregation of data, walls here and there, their capacity to actually run those artificial intelligence models is going to be diminished, number one. Number two, if they cannot provide those services under WTO rules for most of it, around the world without walls, without restrictions, then the upside that they will get out of those massive capital expenditures will be reduced, and then good luck with the valuation. So they have vested interest in pushing in the direction of cooperation, not fragmentation.
So I have to apologize a little to the audience because I let this go on longer than I meant to, but I do want to do at least one round of questions with the audience. Wait. We'll do two from the audience and one online, so we'll take three together. And then I think, Nick, if you could, we'd like you to come up and say a few words when we're done. So I'm going to ask the indulgence volume, we're supposed to end at 8, to stay a little longer while we do this, okay? Okay, so we'll do one question right behind you. And hold that there. And one question, okay, over there. And Danny, I'll come to you after we get the first two for online. Okay, go ahead.
First of all, thank you for taking the time to speak to all of us today. I know it means a lot to everyone here. My question relates to an issue that we're seeing a lot across many countries today, which is the increase in wealth inequality. Mm-hmm. We've seen throughout history how when these issues are kind of kicked down the road and inequality has just led to be increased and increased, eventually it reaches a boiling point where things happen. We've also seen how when measures taken to address that have been too extreme, which hinders innovation and also leads to economic stagnation, which is bad for everyone involved. So mm-hmm. I guess my question relates to how do we address this growing problem in our society, which causes social tension and resentment in many parts of the population without hindering innovation and mm-hmm. Continuing economic growth?
Great. Thank you. Great question. Wherever that was. Oh, you didn't give the microphone to somebody. Well, I suppose so.
Hi, I am Pierre Keladi. I'm a master student in public administration at LSE, and I come from France. You mentioned very well that Europe, interdependency, and investment, but what do you think about the idea to open an European sovereign wealth fund to finance and to share the value about climate, AI, and to be faced about geo-economical fragmentations today? As, for example, Sam Altman mentioned it some weeks ago in a paper, and also maybe next generation EU or a common budget could be helpful, or maybe a common debt. Thank you.
Okay. And if you could bring, you don't have a mic, right? If you could bring the mic down, we'll get one online question.
This is from Lucas Bendersky, who is apparently a very clever year 12 student. How do we ensure the realization of multilateral objectives concerning trade and other financial institutions, given political leaders' constant pursuit of a unilateral agenda? How do you square?
Can you repeat your question?
Yeah.
You didn't get.
How do you square the multilateral agenda and developing multilateral objectives when political leaders have incentives to do things unilaterally?
Okay, and anyone can answer any of those. Just throw that open to you guys.
I'll take the French one.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much. Merci for the question. I'm not inventing anything. This is a common position that has been adopted by the Governing Council of the European Central Bank, mm-hmm. which is that we believe that in the face of the significant challenges and massive investment needs that we have in Europe, meaning defense, the green transition, and now artificial intelligence, or digitalization as we used to call it 2 years ago, I'm sure it's going to change into AI now, which are north of a trillion euros, there has to be a common endeavor. And whether it takes the form of a fiscal common situation, which is currently under debate, but I don't think it's going in that direction well enough, or whether we go towards the creation of European safe assets, which would be considered on a par with the treasury bonds of the United States, is the direction that will be necessary in order to finance this. Second component, which I think is also a necessary condition, it's the creation of a capital market that is one single market with one single supervision institution that provides a completely coordinated and unified system throughout Europe, so that instead of exporting annually 300 billion euros to the rest of the world from the massive savings that we have, we actually invest the savings at home and we encourage innovation, venture capital, and we keep the ideas at home in order to produce the invention of the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, maybe I'll tackle the one about multilateralism and unilateralism and trade, although I wanted to say a quick word on inequality, but maybe later. I think what we need to ask ourselves about multilateralism, when you have leaders who have incentives to think unilaterally and to act beyond thinking, is to try to be very directed in identifying the issues of the global commons that will require multilateral action. Because there's no way that any one leader, and they know it, can solve these problems. And, so we are talking of climate change. I mean, this is an issue of the global commons. It cannot be solved by any one country. We're talking of the pandemic, just to cite two examples. So a very strong premise for multilateralism is to be very clear, have clarity on what are those global public goods that we need that cannot be delivered except through global cooperation and common action. Now comes the issue of, and for this you will need the multilateral institutions, comes the issue of unilateralism. I think one has to be fair. And even though unilateral action may seem unfair and erratic and, you know, whatever word you want to use to us, I start by asking myself the question, let me stick to my area of trade, why did those unilateral actions happen? What is at the base of those actions? Are there any issues there that merit examination? Because if you just rail at unilateralism and you don't try to get to the bottom of it or ask yourself the right questions, then all you do is fume about it without resolving. So I think to deal with that, we've asked ourselves, what are those issues in trade that have led to this unilateralism? And like I said earlier, there are genuine questions on the trade front about, you know, how trade rules are no longer, some of them, not all, are no longer fit for purpose and need to be upgraded to fit the issues that we see today, to fit, as I said, the 21st centuries. You need to ask yourself, you know, are these rules, have they allowed fairness, transparency, competition, a level playing field in trade, or have they slipped? And if you, the answer is yes, then you need to act on that in order not to give the unilateralists the chance to cite that as the problem. So that's where I'm coming from. I think there's a solution in trying to look at these issues, reforming the organizations to tackle those issues and saying, well, hello, here we are. And maybe not all of them can be tackled by the multilateral institutions. Some may have to be tackled elsewhere. But at least those we can take care of, we take care of it. And then we don't have these excuses that we're going unilateral because your multilateral organizational rules are not serving the purpose. So that's my answer. And on inequality, I think, Kristalina, you will answer, I think. But I just wanted to say something, that my biggest worry is when the study we did at the WTO on looking at the impact of trade on AI, which was very positive. We came at it very bullish, but I always joke that I'm not afraid to say how excited we are at the possibility of how AI will reduce trade costs and increase productivity and be very positive. But we also found that this will only happen with, you know, equal adoption of this AI. And if the developing, and if we slip behind in that equal adoption, it will worsen inequality, okay, and not make it better. And that's what worries me, because I feel indeed the developing world will slip behind and global inequality will worsen, and, mm-hmm. and maybe inequality within countries as well. Yep. I'll leave it there.
Yep. So the problem of inequality has been with humanity forever, and the question is where we are headed, and we are not headed in the right direction. What we are seeing is inequality growing. You can measure it in different ways, but by and large the trajectory is upward. And then we ask, what is the cost on society? There is cost, not only in terms of social cohesion, but in terms of people pursuing opportunities and contributing to their fullest potential. Why is inequality growing? It is growing for a good reason and for a bad reason. The good reason is that demonstrably there are countries where the productivity growth is quite high. I think of the largest economy. And this productivity growth comes from giving space for private initiative and having less of instruments to bring that sense of more fairness in society. And it is growing for a very bad reason, and it is that we are observing from the front race for the bottom. Countries striving to offer the lowest possible tax to companies to come there, both foreign investments and domestic investments. There was a process to bring tax harmonization and come up with a minimum 15% corporate tax. It is now stalling. I was in the Philippines recently. I look at the tax to GDP in the Philippines. It is really low, and that is the case in so many emerging market economies that are on this race for the bottom trajectory. At the fund, we believe that a country needs to collect at least 15% tax to GDP to have a functional state. And yet there are so many countries where this ratio is way, way below. The problem is, yes, we are seeing the world becoming richer as a whole. If you look at 1950, since then until now, an average person on this planet is 4.4 times richer. But my professor of statistics used to say, you put your head in the refrigerator, your feet in the oven, your temperature is average, but you're dead. So it is actually a very serious matter for us to recognize that we have to look deeply into what is the distribution of policy, why it is such. You made an excellent point in your question. There has to be space for innovation. We don't want to suck away resources that would drive productivity and growth. But how we make that these choices, it would take to put an end to this race to the bottom. And I was very very sad when I saw that this process has at least for now been derailed. History tells us that when there is a high degree of inequality and perception of unfairness in a society, it sucks away energy that otherwise would be put to a productive use. It also tells us that societies where there is more fairness are happier, even if people pay higher taxes. Look at the Nordics. How to spread these lessons more effectively in a world that, as we have been talking here, has become more fragmented, a little bit more egotistical. This is a very tall order, and I would think we have all responsibilities. We were talking about the role of universities. The more you can keep that issue on the policy research agenda and help countries and institutions like ours to build on that, the better. I see that the mic moved to Nick. I didn't say something, and I feel it is important to be said. When we talk about our institutions and retaining their capacity to do good, one of the things we also have to be very careful is not to spread all over the place, but to keep focus on what we are best at, what we are really good at. This is something that in a world where demand for action is unlimited and resources are limited, is something that we need to also watch. Thus, you do more research so you can fit in our work. And Nick is going to tell us some really fantastic news about research to be done. Thank you.
I'm a bit overawed by the whole occasion, but also deeply moved and appreciative of the extraordinary leaders we have on the platform today. You've shown vision, clarity, realism, wisdom, and importantly, humour. And those are the marks of great leaders, and your record shows you have been great leaders. It's been a great privilege of my life to be able to work with all three of you, and I'm deeply moved that you are here today to celebrate the 80 years. It doesn't seem like that, but to celebrate the 80 years. Thank you, Larry, for hosting us and your leadership here at the school. The friendship and collegiality we've had together has meant so much to me, and I hope that's an example, you know, that friendship helps make things happen and quarrelling prevents good things from happening, which is one of the main themes of what we've had to say. The LSE is about understanding the causes of things for the betterment of society. And you've described very clearly how the failure to collaborate can cause very bad things, devastatingly bad things to happen. Mm-hmm. Nationalism in Europe, you know, two world wars, but of course, way back before that, into earlier centuries, we have European nationalism has been so destructive, and building it back after the Second World War was so important to bring that lasting peace. That's about understanding the causes of things. Unmanaged climate change will be cause deep. It's the poorest, and it's the poorest who get hit earliest and hardest. It's deeply unequal. It will cause mass movement. Unmanaged climate change will cause mass movements of people. It's begun, but if we let it get much worse, and the not just the destruction, but the conflict that would flow from that. Fighting over oil and gas and fossil fuel rents. I mean, you know, go back to Pearl Harbor through what the US and UK did in Iran in the early 50s in overturning democratic government through the 70s and 80s. In the last, of course, few years, again, we've seen how fighting over rents, which is a big part of what we're seeing, is so destructive. So understanding the causes of things is vital if you're to do better. And I wanted to follow what Christine said about great ideas. You gave examples, and the Norman Borlaug one was very close to my heart because I worked on the Green Revolution in India in the 70s. But if you think of the great ideas from social scientists now, Beveridge, one of Larry's predecessors here at the LSE, Keynes.
Yes.
Those ideas changed the world, and they made not simply pointed out how to avoid bad things, but how to create good things. I think Amartya Sen's work on famine and how openness and democracy and can fight famine by fighting the causes of famine, which he identified, of course, as on the demand side and the ability to buy food and access food. Those were changing. Marshall and Pigou helped us understand how markets fail all those years ago, more than 100 years ago. James Mead, you know, one of my great gurus as a young person, was very clear and strong on trade, but also how trade can go wrong and how trade can be managed, not as a universal panacea. Those are all great ideas. Schumpeter and investment and so on. Those are ideas about how things can happen, how things can change for the better, all in the social sciences. I mentioned mostly economists, but if you think, you raised Immanuel Kant, Josie. I mean, the categorical imperative is to behave as we wish all others to behave. Isn't that powerful in this context on climate? It's a notion of duty. I mean, and of course the rights to development are violated if we neglect to manage climate change. The moral philosophy is very powerful. If we lost Jürgen Habermas, a couple of months ago. His idea about democracy being open, informed discussion in the public square, that couldn't be more relevant now. So I've mentioned economics, philosophy, politics, that's what we do here. At the, or we try to do, we do at the LSE. So all that flows into collaboration, and you know, it's late in the day and I mustn't go on too long, but the why and how to collaborate, we have to take those ideas out. We have to take them out philosophically, in the case already given some examples, but they're deeply practical ideas and show how it's done and how it can be done in a context of what is disruption and difficulty. But that is the moment to stand up for those ideas with their philosophical underpinning, but also the deeply practical benefits that flow from getting it right. As they say in India, it's been a big part of my life, it is our duty to do that. And it's our duty as university researchers, teachers, and colleagues to do that. And I think the payoff to standing up now, alongside the duty to stand up now, would be enormous. And I wanted to say one thing about universities that we haven't discussed, which is especially true of the LSE. It's a place where young people from across the world get together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, where Indians and Pakistanis get together, people, you know, from Iran and from other places, where we talk to each other, and we still love our American friends, although we have, you know, some difficulties, some of us, with the current government. But this is the time. This is the time that we can talk. And as I'm the son of a refugee from Hitler's Germany. As a result, I hold a German passport as well as a British passport. And I'm very proud of that bridges. But that's my example of bridging. The bridging that takes place here at LSE is remarkable. And that's why it's so important for our young people to move around in the world, to study in different places and be with each other, and not only develop the ideas, but they have friends and colleagues who develop those ideas with them, and they share that forever. So thank you so much, Christine and Gozi and Christine. It means so much to me that you're here, and it means so much, I think, to all of us in the world that you're doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Nick. Happy birthday to you.
Hip, hip, hip.
Thank you. I told you I would sing.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.